the rod, but the oxygen gets stuck and percolates out towards the side. So then there's a gas pump that collects the gas that doesn't go right through the rod, and that's the supply that people are breathing. So that's the oxygen concentrator. It's not terribly efficient. It only really, at best, can bring it up to about 90 to 92% per se, because there are other techniques that are much better. But for small portable units, and they do come with battery units as well, it seems to be a very useful thing for people who need oxygen and can't carry tanks around.
Now, let me ask you. I'm going to ask a question on this. Ordinary air that we're all breathing right now, something like 21% of it is oxygen. You just said not very efficient, 95%. I'm curious now. I would be getting excess oxygen if you raise the amount going into my lungs to 40% instead of 20%. I would be getting twice normal concentration. I'm having trouble believing 95%. So give me some amplification on that one, Roy. AC2GS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
No, you're quite right. They're not designed, the personal ones are really not designed for a very high percentage. Industrial uses require 99% because otherwise they have to deal with the contaminants. And so although it's an excellent thing, and I don't think any personal filter system works for, you know, up to 90%, that's about the theoretical maximum that this technology can allow. So if you scale it up to industrial oxygen and nitrogen concentrators, it becomes an ineffective method of doing it. And industries have two major different techniques that they use. Originally, it was fractional distillation and cryoprecipitation. They freeze it to a liquid, then they boil it off at different boiling points. They collect the different boiling points, and they get the oxygen, the nitrogen, and the argon, and then they can liquefy it. Another method that's very efficient, that's used most of the time as far as I can see, is something called swing pressure adsorption, which is they use micro sieves that kind of, like activated charcoal, the nitrogen sticks to it, lets the oxygen go through. They pull out the oxygen, they push down the pressure down to even, you know, zero, and it leaches out the nitrogen from another port, and then they go through the cycle, and there's usually two of them, so that when one is charging, one is discharging. That can go to something like 99.9% efficiency.
In the old days when a person had difficulty in breathing, old days, I vaguely remember they put a tent over the person's bed and they pumped oxygen into it. Nowadays, I think they put a cannula or whatever, the piece of tubing up your nose, and they go to an increased concentration of oxygen. I am guessing that depending on the degree of difficulty the person is having, you would either raise the oxygen content a little bit or a whole lot. So how do they control the concentration of oxygen depending on the health of the person? What are the extremes that are used for medical situations these days, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW, the TechNet.
You know, this is a pulmonologist's specialty. Oxygen at given too high a concentration for too long can produce toxicity. It burns things. And so you could burn up a person's lung by giving them 100% pure oxygen for too long. So there are different techniques. The nasal cannula is a very common method. I trained long after the air tents, the oxygen tents, were popular. Back in the really bad old days when there was polio, it wasn't just a matter of oxygen. It was a matter of people's diaphragms didn't work, and that's why there were so many iron lungs out there. Nowadays, there's far less, although there's still people, unfortunately, who are living with an iron lung. There are Venturi devices that mix the air at precise fractions. There's a whole bunch of very interesting gizmos to make sure that the oxygen concentration concentration is high, but not ridiculously high. And you know, if you need it to be ridiculously high, you have a time clock going on, and you know, you better fix whatever's broken before everything falls apart.
Question.
Go right ahead with question.
Hi, N1YDY. There are these things called hyperbaric chambers, which don't increase the percentage of oxygen, but they increase the partial pressure by increasing the total pressure that the person is in. And I'm wondering, does this increase in pressure really have a, or increase in partial pressure really have a noticeable increase in the oxygen uptake of an average human?
Now, the theory and the research demonstrate that it does to an extent. It's very popular, used in people with peripheral vascular disease who have problems getting a lot of oxygen flow to extremities. And if people think that it's a kind of a temporary situation, that if they can get it over the hump, if you will, by increasing the pressure in general, the oxygen will seep in, and you might be able to give that person another chance to regenerate the vessels and the systems that are flawed. So they do hyperbaric oxygen. There's a lot of that in the literature, and they feel that it's beneficial.
Does it actually help? For example, I'm a cancer survivor, and after radiation, I was offered hyperbaric treatment, and I tried a couple of them, and I really didn't notice anything. And when I pressed the physician that was pushing it, he really couldn't answer that it was actually helpful. So I'm just kind of curious if there's any real literature that that shows that it's truly helpful for patients that have had radiation, radiotherapy.
I'm not familiar with the research that demonstrates that. The primary research that I can recall are mostly for infectious processes that are being dealt with, sepsis and such. I don't know. It strikes me as something that sounds like it might work, but no one's been able to prove anything that it does. So that might be what's going on. There's a lot of things that sort of make sense, but factually, there's nothing really behind them yet.
All right, thank you very much, and thank you very much, Dick, for the use of the repeater. And one whitey white.
Oh, that's my little spiel on oxygen concentration, and if anyone has any further questions, it can be addressed, or I could move on to my next topic.
Yeah, I'm kind of amazed at that membrane does the work, because oxygen is a higher number on the periodic table than nitrogen. Is the oxygen molecule, which is O2, larger than a N2 molecule, and is that where the differentiation is taking place? The oxygen doesn't flow through as easily as the nitrogen through the capillaries, and therefore you can do selective of you can select one over the other. So is it the size of the molecule that's giving the differentiation through all of those capillary tubes? Over to you, Roy.
Yes, it's my understanding that other than the fractional distillation, all the other techniques depend upon the fact that that nitrogen molecules are much smaller than oxygen molecules. For the swing pressure adsorption, it's sort of the same phenomena, except that the nitrogen sticks to very small pores on the micro sieves and then gets flushed out. And in the case of the diaphragm or the membrane, it has an unrestricted flow of the nitrogen through the central hole of these little hollow tubes, and blocks the steady flow of the oxygen so it escapes on the side.
Try and make it more simple for people to understand what the hell you guys are talking about.
Would you say that there are millions of those microscopic tubes that are doing that differentiation? Roy, go ahead.
Yeah. don't know the number. It could be something like 10,000. It depends upon. They're very, very small. So there's a lot of them. I don't know if they quite number a million or 100,000 or 50,000. Ultimately, I guess it really depends upon the amount of oxygen you need concentrated, the rate. The greater the rate, the more the tube you need to use.
Like the oxygen you're taking up speaking.
Have you, with your eyes, actually seen that diaphragm or that membrane, Roy? And if so, what does it look like?
Well, again, I wouldn't really call it a diaphragm. It looks like a bottle filled with capillary tubes. At least that's the closest I can describe it.
And these oxygen concentrators that people with, say, emphysema might use as they walk around during the day or as they're living in their home, roughly how expensive are they? Does a patient actually buy that thing, or does almost everybody rent a machine that does that? Over to you, Roy.
My guess is these are rentals, and they're usually covered, if you're lucky, by insurance, as most medical and surgical supplies tend to be.
I got a comment for that, too, in one way, Dwight.
You got it, Hank.
From experience, I can tell you that even though you can buy them usually for less than the cost of the rental for the time that you'll have one, your insurance doesn't want you to do that. So there's some kind of financial model that encourages rental rather than ownership.
Interesting. You've got it, Roy.
Hey, that's news to me. You know, being from the other side of the profession, you just write the orders for things. You don't know about the economics, unfortunately. But I guess they have a better deal. There's also a maintenance that's required. You have to change filters. You have to do a lot of upkeep. And it's probably the money that they change hands for the rental factor is in the maintenance cost, where the outright purchase doesn't. So it might just be an economical situation to maintain these things because they're not self-supporting, yet you have to be able to fix them and clean them and change them.
Well, I can only tell you that when my father was sick, we had one, and I maintained it. It wasn't very difficult, and the cost to own and maintain was approximately a third of the cost that the insurance company would have borne if we had gone that route.
Now, make sure when we hand it over to you, Hank, you wait for the beeps. How often did it require maintenance? Once a week? Once a month? Over to you, Hank. Wait for the beeps.
Eric, you got it. About once every 2 weeks, I changed the filter, and there was a set of O-rings that had to be replaced, too. That was the only tricky part, but the general filter stuff was very easy. And one way to way.
You got it, Eric. If you go to the oxygenconcentratorstore.com, you'll see they have units that start at $1,650, portable ones that run for 3 hours, to the ones that are portable, bigger, they run for about 5.5 hours on a battery, that's $4,000. There's all different price ranges for different lengths of time. 10-hour battery is $6,000. And then, of course, from this site, they also do sell all the support stuff and everything else. So, I mean, it's kind of cost-effective, and you can buy them. I think you probably do need a prescription for it, but it doesn't say. QRWK, too, Jeff. Thank you, Eric. Hank, you had to replace the filter every 2 weeks. Does that mean you buy a pile of these filters and the old filter is a throwaway, or do they get recycled? N1YDY, K2RIW, wait for the beeps.
And then to wheel.
It's been a couple of years, but I recall that the filters came in a box of five and that they were disposable. N1YDY.
You've got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick, why do I need oxygen? But, you know, the wheelchair I had, they said to me the hover-round cost about $5,000, and I think that's all because of medical. And it was picked up mainly by Medicare and a little bit by Medicaid. And it's a bandage I'm getting from Medicare or Medicaid, I don't know which one. They supply me with food, 21 meals a week. So there's a breakfast, lunch, and dinner for each meal. It's a very nice arrangement. And if anybody needs the name of that company, it's called Top Chef Meals. You can look it up on the internet. And if you have Medicare or Medicaid or something else, I'll cover it.
If it was breakfast, dinner, and breakfast, lunch, and dinner, 21 meals a week. 21 meals a week, is that what you said? Yes. I think that tells, yes, that's all 7 days. How about that? I was thinking per month. I was about to ask you what you do for the rest of the days. That's a pretty nice deal. Okay. Somebody else had a comment?
Antics, Ian. Actually, I have a whole line for receivers and filters for nitrogen, liquid nitrogen production, so... if you want a few more information, I can edit.
Yeah, but we were talking about oxygen concentrators, not nitrogen concentrators. Roy, go on to your next subject. EC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I want to mention a book that I read last week, you know, a little book report. It's called the Chemical History of a Candle, and it's written by this guy who I think has a great future in front of him. You might have heard of him, Michael Faraday.
Doesn't sound like a recent book, but you're saying he did a thorough analysis of what gets combusted in a typical candle, how many candle power, what light you get output, how much soot you get out of it. So, did he dig pretty deep into it, Roy?
Yes, he dealt with it very deeply. They used to have, well, they still do. The Royal Institute in England has these Christmas demonstrations for young people, and he was a very popular person at the time, which is about 150 years ago. And he did a series of Christmas specials on the subject of the candle, and he discussed many, many interesting aspects. I mean, he discussed the weight of a cubic foot of room air, as you did. He discussed flames. He discussed electrolysis. He discussed all kinds of fascinating things. And there are many reprints based on that Royal Institute. And if anyone wants to see a recreation on video, I put an alias. All you have to do is type candle.ac2gs.com, and it will take you to a series of YouTubes where an engineer-type guy has redone all of Michael Faraday's Royal Institute talks on the history of the chemistry of the candle, and it's quite fascinating. One of the things that he mentioned that I found interesting, he exploded hydrogen and demonstrated that it gives off water vapor, and he even explained the reason that the hydrogen got its name, because apparently hydrogen was one of the earliest discovered gases, and hydrogen, if you really take it apart, it's hydro is water and gen is generating. So the fact that you can burn hydrogen and get left with water, they gave it the name gas that makes water. And so it makes a lot of sense why hydrogen is called hydrogen.
Well, let's see what the Martians say.
Oh, know. If you ever get a message from them, please pass it along. Anyway, that's my little spiel on Michael Faraday's book. I found it very interesting. It's reasonably cheap. If one has a Kindle, they sell it for 99 cents. You can probably find it online. And I've directed people to a YouTube of a dramatization of the talks, which is quite interesting. You will learn stuff, even though it's 150 years ago. The man was kind of smart and very engaging. Now, getting to the end of last week's TechNet, KAC2LR made a comment about something that she was interested in finding out more about. She sort of wanted to know how the heck everyone seems to know how much things weigh and how far they are if you can't get anywhere and you can't measure them, you know, astronomy. So if there's anyone out there who would like me to kind of discourse on all the kind of clever ways that astronomers have for figuring out where things are and how heavy things are and why some things unfortunately don't make a lot of sense, then let's hear from anyone.
WS2N, one comment.
Full.
I'm just going back a step to the hydrogen and oxygen. You know, when you watch those space shuttles take off, there's 135 space shuttles over all those years. The exhaust coming out, down the center, the three engines in the shuttle itself, after the boosters separate, you can see clearly that any of that smoke is all vapor. It's basically water. So it's the burning of your hydrogen and oxygen. They have liquid hydrogen on board as the fuel and liquid oxygen. So the result is water vapor. So back to you, Brian.
I think you're saying, Paul, that white trail that we see as the exhaust of the space shuttle was really a cloud of water vapor condensing from the exhaust because it's burning pure oxygen, pure hydrogen. Therefore, it's making pure water and very little else. Is that basically what we were seeing? And a whole lot of noise. Over to you, Paul.
Yes, that's right, but you have to exclude the solid boosters. So that's why, you know, when you look at the shuttle after the boosters have separated, whatever you see there is pure water vapor. I mean, most of what you see when it takes off is also, you know, water vapor too, but you have the exhaust also from the solid boosters, so you can't go by that. And the same with the other couple of rockets that fly the same fuel. You have the Ariane 5 rocket that's launched by European Space Agency, and that has two solid boosters on it as well. So once those boosters are clear, when you're looking at the exhaust of the Ariane 5 rocket, it's the same thing. And on these Delta 4 rockets that go up from either California or Florida, the Delta 4s are also hydrogen oxygen engines. RS-68A engines. They're big engines on those Delta 4s. It's the same fuel. Not the same for other rockets, but they're the three main ones. The Delta 4, the Space Shuttle, and Ariane 5. And in the future, when we watch the new SLS Space Launch Systems go up for NASA, those flights will also have the same results as Roy's liquid hydrogen and oxygen explanation turning into vapor. Back to you, Dick.
I might be wrong, but I think some of the rockets are using a kerosene-like mixture with liquid oxygen. How do they choose whether they're going to use kerosene, liquid oxygen, versus hydrogen liquid oxygen. How do they make that choice? What's the advantage and disadvantage on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW.
Okay, I don't want to take this time away from the physics part, but in short, it's the way they evolved. For instance, the Russians evolved with kerosene because they, you know, they stored better. They're derived from intercontinental ballistic missiles, you know, these ICBMs. The original rockets that we used, the Redstone and the Titans, were all derived from, they had to sit for a long time in a silo somewhere, so you couldn't use the liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. That wouldn't have worked out. Back to you there.
Now, Roy, the last thing you mentioned is that measuring diameters, weights, sizes, and distances of objects in space. You mailed me a very nice website that I went to a number of those YouTube videos, and they're very educational. I'll bet you, if I know you, you've got a compact URL you could be telling our listeners by which they can easily get to that site if they want to know, over the years, how did the really smart, astronomically enthusiastic people figure out how big each star was, how big each planet is, how far away each planet and each star was, and what they were consisting of. AC2GS, K2RIW, you got it right.
AC2GS, yes, you know me well, Dick. And so, if any of you would like to type astronomy, and hopefully you guys know how to spell astronomy, .ac2gs.com, it'll take you to a guy's YouTube page. He's a astronomy professor at Loyola, and he really does love to make up YouTube. He has hundreds of them, and they are very, very informative, and they don't leave anything to the imagination. And I thought that we would deal with some aspects of that tonight, and see how people, different parts of it that might interest them for tonight's session.
WS2N, comment on that?
Yeah, Paul.
I watched some of those YouTubes that you're talking about, and there's a whole, like you said, a whole series of them. But the one I liked was the one where, back in the olden times, they were looking into a well, and they noticed the angle of the shadow. And the well was, not hitting the sun was coming up, but not hitting it exactly right at the highest point of the sun during that day. And then they located another well, some thousands of miles away, and they figured out that this was coming in directly with no shadow. So they figured out the angle and came out to some 7.5 degrees or something. Based on that, they could take the... They subtracted the 7.5 to 365 degrees, and then they multiplied it times the distance between the two locations. And, you might remember how many years ago this was, but, it was, thousands of years ago or something in the Egyptian days, I think. And they figured out that the Earth was around. Back to you.
Yeah, that was Aristoxenes. He was a Greek. It was the time of right after Alexander the Great. It was about 200 B.C. And he pretty much figured out both that the Earth was round, which I think I mentioned a few months ago when we were discussing flat earthers, that they knew it was round more than 2,000 years ago. And he got it right by about 20%, which is damn good for one calculation in two different places. So he was very good at that. There was another Greek philosopher called Aristarchus who figured out the distance, the size of the moon from the lunar and solar eclipses, and used that to figure out with angles the distance of the moon. He tried to figure out the distance of the Earth to the sun. But the angle that's made is such a small angle that he was off by ridiculous numbers. I think off by 200 or 400 fold. This all took place 200 years B.C., so those Greek philosophers were rather smart. I mean, some of them just sat on rocks, but others did actual experiments and found out incredible things.
In the case of the sun's shadow or the sunshine going down a deep well, and if you pace the number of paces, they didn't use miles, they used some other unit of measure. Let me drop it. You pace the distance between the two wells. Let's assume the two wells are 150 or 250 miles apart, so to speak. If you had an accurate clock, and you could tell the difference in time when the sun would go down the well that's first more to the east, and a little bit later it goes down the well to the west. If you had an accurate clock at those two places 150 miles apart, I'm having trouble believing they had an accurate clock. So they couldn't do it by clock time. If the two wells were north and south of each other, and you know the rate at which the sun goes 22 and a half degrees north and 22 degrees south of the equator, and you measure the day of the year, and you calculate the angles that way, because the two wells are north and south of each other, that strikes me as a much more accurate way. But if those wells were east and west, and they didn't have an accurate clock, then the timing could be a big error creator, I think. I think the article didn't quite go into those details. Maybe you know that one, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW, the tech man.
They mentioned the two cities. I think they were both Egyptian cities at the time. And I'm trying to recollect if it's north and south. I kind of get the sense that it was east and west. And I don't know how they correlated the time back then. I would assume all they had to do was sundials. But I don't know. I think, though, it was east and west.
WS1.
Yeah, if it's east and west and you're using a sundial, at high noon on the eastern one, you'll see it go down. At high noon on the western one, you'll see it go down the well. And that doesn't tell you how much time there was difference between the two. You've got it, Paul. WS2N, K2IW.
I was under the impression it was a north-south situation. You see, Alexandria was on the Mediterranean. And then the other place was inland more. I don't remember the name of that. But they were going by high noon. They knew, you know, but not necessarily high noon, but they knew whatever the highest peak of the sun was, you know, at that time. And that's what they were going by. So they could match that, you know. So in other words, one guy in Alexandria is looking at the sun. He knows exactly when that sun, or, you know, within a couple of minutes of when that sun has reached its peak, the highest degree off the horizon. And then the other guy, he would know the same thing. So I thought that's what they were going by. Back to you, Roy.
Clinton 1, Whitey White.
You got it, Hank. Wait for the beeps.
My understanding that it's a simple trigonometry, angle side angle, and they knew the local distance between the two points, and they knew in whatever unit they were using, which obviously wasn't a mile, but they also knew the angle at each time for local apparent noon, and they were able to correct for the difference in local apparent noons by noting the distance between the two points, and one Whitey White.
You still need an accurate clock. I mean, if high noon occurs on the eastern city at 12 o'clock universal time, and at the more western city, 1 o'clock universal time, that's great if you both know universal time. Without an accurate clock, you don't know the difference in time between those two events. AC2GS, K2LAW.
He disagreed.
Okay. How do the two guys know what Greenwich Mean Time is?
They clearly don't know GMT, but what they did know is the local apparent noon, and they knew the distance in whatever units they were using. They weren't trying to fix the distance because they already had determined that. So what they were trying to do was to determine the size of the whole pie by figuring out the same angle at each local noon. So you really don't need the time aspect if you're just looking for the circumference of the Earth, the circumference of whatever sphere you're on.
Hold on now, Hank. Will you admit that the sun goes down the well to the east at a certain time? The sun goes down the well to the west at a later time. How do you know how much time has elapsed for the sun to go down the more western well?
Gation.
I'm looking it up, and basically Alexandria was in the northern Egypt, and the other city was Syene, was in southern Egypt. So it was north-south, not east-west. Sorry, guys.
Of whatever you're measuring, the reflection on the water in the well or whatever the angle is, and have a similar well with a similar depth at which you could determine a similar angle at whatever your local apparent noon is.
Now, you two guys doubled, but turns out that Roy told us that the two wells were north and south of each other. So it's a different day of the year when the sun goes down at those wells. And then by knowing how fast the sun goes from the Tropic of Cancer to the Tropic of Capricorn, so to speak, how many days it takes for one to go from the other, that's how they could figure out the angular distance between the two wells, and therefore calculate the diameter of the Earth. If they were east and west of each other, you have to have a universal clock, which they didn't have, in my opinion. AC2GS, K2LAW.
They also used the summer solstice, so that was the time that they made the measurement where it went straight down the well in Alexandria and veered off at an angle in Syene.
So you're saying they were measuring that angle that it missed the bottom of the well, is what I think you're saying, at summer solstice. That's another way of figuring out the angle.
That's the way they're describing it. WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
In the book Cosmos, Carl Sagan said they used a stick. I'll have to go check, but just by putting a stick in the ground, they could measure the angle that way as well. But I believe they had the same kind of description. I don't think they used a well in that book. But whatever, it worked. You know, they took that 7.5 degrees, they divided that into the 360 degrees, and then they were able to multiply that times whatever the distance was between the two cities. And they said they got it pretty close, like Roy said, you know, for that time period. And you said a couple of hundred years before, was it 200 years BC? Is that what you said, Roy? Wow, very good. Back to that.
Yeah, many of those Greek philosophers were incredibly clever people, and it's a shame that they weren't experimentally involved. They could have come up with much more interesting things. You have, unfortunately, Plato and Aristotle that just kind of sat on rocks and thought up good ideas, but didn't even imagine doing any experiments to prove anything. So they came up with those wonderful crystal spheres that planets and stars were supposed to revolve about us with. Anyway, so all these things were figured out 200 BC, and unfortunately things kind of didn't take off from there.
dark ages and what have you, until the discovery of optics and the telescope and good old Galileo and such. And finally we go to Isaac Newton, who described the fact that the sun gave off a continuous spectrum of light, but kind of left it at that. He really didn't do anything with what we would call modern spectroscopy. That had to wait until a guy called Fraunhofer. And if you've ever played MP3 songs, their patent is owned by something called the Fraunhofer Institute, which is named in Fraunhofer's memory. And so he was the guy who first figured out spectral lines. Now, with spectroscopy, there's three different types of spectroscopy, and for that that jump forward in technology, we have to thank a guy named Kirchhoff, who a lot of electrical engineers know Kirchhoff because he has electrical circuit laws. He did work in thermal chemistry. He did a whole bunch of things, but he did stuff in spectroscopy as well. And he had three types of spectrums. He had a continuous spectrum, the red, green, blue that we see in the rainbow and such that you get out of prisms. There are things called emissive spectrums in which electrons are excited and give off energy, and there's little teeny bands of light at specific frequencies. And there's absorptive spectra in which those atoms, instead of giving up the energy, take it up and darken the background. So those are the three types of spectrums available. Now, the beauty of a full continuous spectrum is something that gets very confusing, called black body radiation. And usually people look upon black body radiation and they say, I don't understand, it's coming from a black thing. And one of the examples of a black body radiator is the sun. And to most people looking at the sun, it doesn't quite look like a black body or black or anything. But that's because of what black body radiators mean. It doesn't mean that they don't radiate anything. It means that they pretty much don't reflect anything. And most of the light that you're going to see coming off the sun is made by the sun. It's not reflected from any place else. There's no such thing as a perfect black body, only imperfect black bodies, the same way as there's no such place as 0 degrees Kelvin and objects that have a rest mass that can travel at the speed of light. These are all unattainable limits. So that's black body radiation. But there's a very interesting thing about black body radiation. Let me drop. If you graph out the illumination according to frequency, you will find a very interesting curve that peaks at a particular point. And using something called Swine's Law, you can plug in the peak the peak color frequency of the curve and figure out the surface temperature of the black body. So using that simple method, you can tell the color of almost any star out there in the sky, which I find fascinating. Now, it doesn't tell you the core temperature, unfortunately. These are all surface phenomena. But one of the things that we now know how to do is we can tell the temperatures of all the stars in the sky. I think that's great. We also can move on to the absorption spectra, and we can tell what's on the surface of the sun because it leaves a little mark. Every element has a specific set of bands, and you can look at them, record them, write them down, which Kirchhoff did, and you can figure out what the hell is on the surface of any star, which I think is fascinating. And you would find out that about 75% of it is hydrogen, 25% of it is helium, and about 1% is just about every element up to and including uranium. interesting. Now know what stars are made of. And different size stars have different ratios of things, and they're different sizes, and they're different heats, and they're different qualities in general. But you now know a composition and a temperature.
I've got an example, Roy, the so-called black body. I'll throw this one out at you. A carbon rod, to the average person looking at it in daylight, looks about as black as you could get. If I take a pair of carbon rods and put them into something called an arc light, where at the tips they're just about touching each other, a high voltage is placed between the two, a lot of local heating is taking place, so that black rod near the tip where it's getting hot, I can see places where it's red, orange, yellow, white, blue, and so on. So just by changing the temperature of a portion of that black carbon rod, I will see those other colors being generated. So that's a black body being elevated in temperature and emitting some particular color as viewed by a human eye. AC2GS, K2IW.
Yes, that's a perfect example. People see it a lot in iron. If you ever see kind of blacksmith type of work, when they first stick the iron into the fire, it turns a bright red, and then it moves on to orange, and then to yellow, and that's a black body. Human beings are perfect examples of black body radiation. We emit infrared, though, so we can't sense it on each other. But if you have the pleasure of using an infrared detector, and you point it at the guy next to you, they light up like a Christmas tree. The bottom line is almost everything that isn't perfectly 0 degrees Kelvin will have some degree of black body radiation emission. Very often, they will be in equilibrium with their environment, so objects will dissipate heat into the environment, but the environment will dissipate heat into them to those objects, and so you equilibrate, and that's why things don't get warmer or colder unless you apply some energy to them. But that's black body radiation, and there's a lot that you can tell from black body radiation. But there's a lot of things that you can tell about spectrum, because there are some things that change with spectrum that are very important. Let me drop. The most obvious, going back to a previous discussion we had, are Doppler shifts. So if you look for the little bar where hydrogen is absorbed, you'll see that some stars are showing it in the kind of wrong position. They seem to be redshifted, like, you know, in the wrong place. But what's going on is you're seeing redshift of a Doppler, and that star is going away from you at a given velocity, and you plug in the Doppler shift equation, and now you can find out the relative velocity of different things in relation to you based upon the Doppler shift, based upon their absorption spectrum. So now you've learned another thing. But there's even more. You can figure out temperature in a slightly different way, because there are things out there that that kind of only exist under certain circumstances and under certain temperatures. Just as a kind of question for the audience, what do you think? How do you think helium was discovered?
I think it was discovered on the sun.
Indeed, give that man a gold star. That's why it's called helium, for Helios, for the sun. Before it was ever seen on the Earth, it was seen as a spectroscopic set of values, and people kind of looked up there and knew that there was a lot of it in the sun, but they didn't know what it was until they finally found little trapped portions and did spectroscopic analysis on the Earth, and whoa, they had helium. The problem is sometimes that bites you on the backside. because the same time that they were declaring the existence of helium, they were discussing the existence of a new element called nebulum. So in the same way, they went around looking for some nebulum on the planet Earth. And unfortunately, they finally figured out that what nebulum was is a very, very rare form of ionized oxygen. It's doubly ionized oxygen that exists in very, very, and I'm talking very, very, low-density gas clouds, such that if you tried to make a vacuum and put a little bit of oxygen in there, you wouldn't have enough of a vacuum to have a low enough density to have doubly ionized oxygen. So what they thought was a new element was just an interesting version of oxygen that was sitting in a nebula. So once again, the rule is that science can be fooled, and often is, but thankfully we check, double-check, triple-check, and figure out these things that they got wrong. I didn't do any of it, unfortunately. But so that's the story with nebulum and helium. And there are other things that you could do with the spectral lines. As I mentioned, you can grade the temperatures even finer than the blackbody radiation can do. There are 7 spectral classes for stars. We're at G. And you can break those further into 10 subunits. And the sun is a G2. And that's usually based upon the absorption of different gases, because as you increase the temperature, you excite the atoms to a higher energy state. You decrease the amount of absorption in those frequency ranges. And so the bands kind of, as you raise the temperature, the bands become a little bit more obvious and then they fade away. And so they've correlated it down to a letter class, 7 letter classes, and 10 subclasses for each letter class. So, they now know that we're a G2 as opposed to other stars out there. But there's even more that you can discover with spectroscopy, because the same way that a star that has a velocity going away from you has a shift, think of in terms of about a sun that's spinning, that has a rotation. On one side, it has a given velocity going away from you, but on the other side, it has a velocity coming towards you. So you can actually tell from the width of some absorption lines the Doppler shift on both sides. It kind of makes it fuzzy and less distinct. So from the change in the reference width of the spectral line, you could glean the angular velocity of a star. That's another thing you can pick up on a spectroscope. So you got temperatures, you got compositions, you got velocities, and the question, though, is the mass of these things. How the heck do you find out the mass? It's kind of difficult to figure out a trick where spectrums will give you an actual mass of an object. Unfortunately, they haven't figured that trick. So they figured other little tricks, and one of them is simple geometry and trigonometry, and that requires something called parallax. Parallax is the difference in angle of seeing some image based upon the relation that the Earth is at the time that you're comparing it. Usually, they'll take a picture of an object in the background. They'll wait for the sun, for the Earth to revolve one astronomical unit to the side, take another picture, look at the angles, and plug in the equation. And that's actually where the concept of a parsec was first discerned. A parsec is a parallax arc second. An arc second is 1/3600th of a degree. So you can imagine how small that angle is, but the distance is one parsec is something like, I think it's 2.5 light years. So The problem with that is that it's very difficult to get these fine angles because, you know, we're dealing in arc seconds. We're dealing in fractions of arc seconds because there's no real thing that's around 2 or 3 light years away. You got to get about 5 or 6 to have anything interesting out there. So it requires incredible accuracy, and it still is only useful for local star systems. But you can calculate the mass. If you calculate the distance from it, and from the distance you can calculate masses and all kinds of wonderful stuff. Then you can sort of correlate the type of star with the mass, and you start to draw these wonderful diagrams. And there's a bunch of guys who came up with wonderful diagrams. One is called the HR diagram, which plots luminosity versus velocity, and will give you an idea of how big things are. You kind of plug them in, and you get these wonderful curves. And there's another one that gave us the Hubble constant. They plug in these things to the velocity and the distance and such, and they discern the Hubble constant. As you go farther and farther away, things are going faster and faster. And the interesting thing I find about the Hubble, let me drop. The interesting thing that I find about the Hubble constant is that the inverse of the Hubble constant, if you calculate it, is approximately the age of the universe, because it gives you the time, the negative time, when everything was 0 meters per second away from each other. The trouble with the Hubble constant, unfortunately, is that it's not really a constant. It changes over time. And the way that they learned how it changes over time is due to another little trick that astronomers use. Let me drop. There's some very interesting stars out there that have known masses and luminosity. One of them is called a variable star. They're called Cepheids, and they oscillate. And depending upon the period that they oscillate, you can actually look up what their mass and luminosity is, and you can get a good idea for a lot of things going on in that area. The trouble with Cepheids is that they're not the most bright stars that you can look at. So they're good for kind of medium range, but they're not really good for distance. The ones good for distance is something called a 1A supernova. 1A supernovas are basically those small little white dwarfs, stars in a binary system that take in star material from its partner, and they're usually at about 1.4 solar masses, and then they go into a supernova. So they generate a lot of light for a very short amount of time. They give a spectral signature that's very obvious, and they all have approximately the same mass and the same mass, and so you can figure out the distances and such from it. The same luminosity, same mass, you figure out the distance. And they found out something that was very disparaging. They plugged it into the Hubble constant, and that was the point where they realized in their fear that the Hubble constant was changing in the wrong direction, that the universe, instead of slowing down, was accelerating. So that's how we even know about the acceleration of the universe, is based on type 1A supernovas exploding and giving us values as far as direction.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Question?
Go ahead, Hank.
So is the Cepheid, or is it the Type 1A supernova that is described as the, quote, standard candle, unquote?